What is going on, everybody, and welcome back to episode 6 of the Royal Hour. I, of course, am Joseph Royal, your host here, and man, we have a loaded show today. We are going to talk about a lot of things. Before I get into any of these topics, please, if you're watching on YouTube, like, share, and subscribe. It really helps me out. And by all means, leave your thoughts in the comment section. Been kind of quiet around here. Leave your thoughts in the comment section. Anything that you feel about the episode, anything that could be better. If I talk about anything that you're interested in that you might want to give your comments about, by all means, like, make your voice heard in the comment section. I love to hear back from you guys. If you're listening on any of the streaming sites like Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, I appreciate all the support. It is very much appreciated. Today, we are going to get into NFL Week 11. We are also going to talk about this Charles Barkley take that he gave last night on TV about Kenny Atkinson's exit from the New Jersey, Brooklyn Nets during their coverage of the Celtics and Cavaliers game. We're going to get into that. We're also going to get into my UFC 309 review. We're going to talk about the Tyson Paul match spectacle that happened this past Friday. And we're going to talk about WWE heading into Survivor Series because, quite frankly, I feel like some of these storylines are coming up a bit short for me. Some of these episodes of episodic television, they're coming up short for me. So we're going to get into all of that. And we actually will start with week 11 as we mostly always do. We will talk about week 11 of the NFL season. A pretty good crop of games this week. I'd say that most of these games were fairly competitive, even if just in the early, outside of the game. But the ones that we really expected to hit definitely did hit. We can start with the Thursday night game, Commanders and the Eagles. This was a really hotly contested game. Jaden Daniels struggled just a little bit, 22 for 32, 191 yards, one touchdown and one pick. Not too bad. They kept him relatively clean against this pretty good pass rush from the Philadelphia Eagles. He did get sacked 3 times, but nothing that really derailed their, the game for them. Just more so situationally, Philly just got the job done with big time playmakers and big time situations. Austin Eckler had 8 catches for 89 yards. That's really impressive considering he hasn't really looked, they haven't used him as really the feature back. I think Brian Robinson Jr. Is more of the feature back. You know, Austin Eckler only had 2 catches for 7 yards. They're using him as more of a receiving back now. But Jalen Hurts played really steady, even though he didn't throw a touchdown, 18 for 28, 221. Saquon Barkley, 26 carries, 146 yards, 2 touchdowns. That dude's just a stud, man. An absolute stud. Devontae Smith was held fairly in check, 4 catches for 29 yards. A.J. Brown, 5 for 65. The Commanders relatively kept them in check. Like I said, it was just a matter of some big plays by Saquon Barkley that got this done. And, you know, Jalen Hurts played mistake-free football. They kept him relatively clean, only 2 sacks, and that was the story of this game. But Washington's for real, man. And obviously Philly's for real, despite how much their fans want to complain about the head coach. Let's get into the Sunday games. The Rams and the Patriots. This was a much more entertaining game than I expected it to be. The Rams took this one 28-22. They moved to 5-5. The Patriots dropped to 3-8. Matthew Stafford, 18 for 27, 295, 4 touchdowns, no picks. Very good game for Cooper Kupp and Puka Nacua. Nacua had 7 catches for 123 yards and a touchdown, including one impressive diving catch for a touchdown. And that was just amazing. Right in the end zone, threw it to the, I don't even say the back pylon, but threw it sort of towards the sideline. He just dove and caught it. It was an amazing catch, especially in that situation. Cooper Kupp, 6 for 106 and 2 touchdowns. Their 2 big receivers really came up huge in this game. Drake May, 30 for 40, 282, 2 touchdowns and 1 pick. Like I said, he continues to show signs that they made the right choice picking him in this draft. I do not agree with him playing behind this offense, or I should say I did not agree. I mean, I'm kind of warming up to the situation. Their offensive line has gotten things together a little bit more. but still not exactly the offensive line you want behind your prized rookie quarterback. Ramondre Stevenson, 20 for 73. They really need to bolster this receiving core. I'm just not impressed. Demario Douglas continues to show that he has earned a spot on this team when they become, you know, more of a contender as far as getting high-priced and high draft pick receivers in this lineup. It has shown that Demario Douglas would fit in. He can create separation, make plays after the catch, etc., etc. The rest of these guys, Kendrick Bourne, Hunter Henry's seen better days. He's had a couple of injuries. Austin Hooper, you know, Kayshon Booty. It's just, I'm not a huge fan of this receiving core. It's kind of the same issue as last year. They have a huge issue when it comes to creating separation. So the Rams took that one. Colts and the Jets. I mean, at this point, this Jets team is just, oof. They fired their GM. I'll get into that in a little bit. But the Colts took this one on the road in Anthony Richardson's return to the starting lineup. 28-27, last second touchdown, essentially, or late touchdown. They moved to 5-6. The Jets dropped to 3-8. Anthony Richardson, 20 for 30, 272, one touchdown and no picks. I would say this is I'd say this is probably his best. This is probably his best, or definitely one of his best pro games since coming into the league. He just played really poised, looked a lot more comfortable in the pocket. Only got sacked twice. Jonathan Taylor, 24-57. They held him relatively in check. But Anthony Richardson played really well. As we go over to the offensive side, Aaron Rodgers did a pretty decent job of taking care of the ball. They did a decent job of protecting him, just not in crucial situations. 22 for 29, 184. Two touchdowns, no picks. Breece Hall, 16 for 78. Devontae Adams, 6 for 72. Breece Hall, 7 for 43. Garrett Wilson was held in check, 4 for 18. It's hard for me to even take pride or care to break down what the Jets would, quote-unquote, need to do to right the ship. There is no righting the ship this year. We're already seeing reports that it's highly unlikely that they're going to bring Aaron Rodgers back in 2025. Devontae Adams has essentially come to the Jets and, you know, he thought he was going to be on a team that was going to turn it around and be competing for, I don't know what he thought, a championship. It's not happening. You know, they fired their GM, which is interesting because of the fact that when you really think about it, Aaron Rodgers has his offensive coordinator there. He had Randall Cobb there. He has Adam Lazard there. Traded for Devontae Adams. Worked out the situation with Hassan Reddick. For them to fire him is really, in my opinion, using him as a scapegoat here. I think Woody Johnson is clearly the bigger issue. I think he's a lower profile version of Jerry Jones in the fact that he infringes upon the process that the guys he has hired to get these things done, you know, he infringes on the process that they go through. And it has harmed the Jets. It has made them irrelevant when it comes to competing teams in the league. Their relevance has come from one championship in a bygone era when a relatively average quarterback made a guarantee because he had some, as the kids say, Riz back in the day. That's where the Jets' relevance came from for the longest time. They were a whipping boy for the Patriots for the longest time. Rex Ryan came and reignited, you know, the Jets into the mainstream with, you know, a lot of the talent they brought around and just the overall culture that he brought. And then that ended pretty sour. Then they drafted Zach Wilson as high as they did. That was a huge mistake. Then they hired Aaron Rodgers' boy as the OC, demoted him from play calling, elevated Todd Downing. This offense still does not look impressive with all of the weapons they have. This is a dumpster fire. And you can't really blame Aaron Rodgers for all of this. I won't even say you can blame him for a majority of this. I'd say he gets somewhere from 35 to 40% just for bringing Nathaniel Hackett with him. I think that alone carries about 35 to 40% of the blame. Not even anything he's done personally, Aaron Rodgers. Just bringing, like, nothing he's done on the field. Just bringing Nathaniel Hackett along, alone, carries the weight of about 35 to 40% of the blame. You know, so where do they go from here? I don't know. Do you blow it up again? Right? Because every time you replace a quarterback that you drafted high, make no mistake about it, you are blowing it up. Even if you fall back somewhat on your feet by, you know, getting an Aaron Rodgers, you're still blowing it up. You're still trying to create a new culture, but the culture of the Jets is Woody Johnson's insistence on infringing upon the process of the people he puts in charge. So Joe Douglas getting fired, Robert Saleh getting fired, Aaron Rodgers looking like a shell of himself, all of this is a reflection of the culture of the Jets. Underperforming, lofty expectations that are unfounded when you know the history of the Jets, right? And I'm not one of those people that go along with the, oh, well, the Jets will be the Jets. I usually am not like that. But when you say the Jets will be the Jets, you're pointing, or if you say the Cowboys will be the Cowboys, you're pointing to the common denominator. In both of those situations, the common denominator is the owners. So that's what I'll say about the Jets situation. I have a feeling that other than stuff that happens off the field, I won't be talking about the Jets at length anymore this season. So, let's move on to what I consider the, well, I'll say the second best game of the weekend. But maybe the most anticipated game for a lot of people, the Ravens and the Steelers. The Steelers took this one 18-16 at home. Ravens dropped to 7-4. The Steelers extend their win streak to 8-2. Or extend their win streak and move on to 8-2. Lamar Jackson, 16 for 33, 207, one touchdown and one pick. Derrick Henry, 13 for 65. They held him relatively in check. I don't even say relatively in check. He really didn't have that good of a game. You know, they stacked the box, tried to make Lamar Jackson sort of beat them while keeping him in the pocket. And a lot of those receivers could not extend the play other than, you know, guys like Isaiah Likely. He had one long catch after extending the play and continued down the sideline for a pretty long game, but eh. I mean, this receiving core needs to play a lot better. Deontay Johnson, two targets, no catches. You know, so I guess Mike Tomlin saying they have a lot of other targets to worry about was pretty apropos. Russell Wilson continues to play pretty well. 23 for 36, 205. No touchdowns, one pick. Really bad pick. Excuse me, in the back of the end zone. You know, but it didn't really affect the game as much as I thought it did. The Steelers defense pretty much just picked him up. So that was that game. I think these teams will definitely be seeing each other down the road. And I would definitely invite another matchup between them in the playoffs. I think they have one more divisional game, if I'm not mistaken. But I'd love to see them play in the playoffs. Lions and the Jaguars. Is there anything to talk about with the Jaguars anymore? I mean, is there anything to talk about with the Lions anymore other than them just trouncing guys? 52-6. The Lions move to 9-1. The Jacksonville Jaguars drop to 2-9. Not much to see here. Flat out blowout. Mac Jones is the starter right now, as Trevor Lawrence, I believe, is going to be out for the rest of the season. 17 for 29, 138, no touchdowns, one pick. He played relatively well, quite honestly. He had a pretty bad pick, but I mean, you know, Mac Jones is going to be a starter somewhere in this league eventually. Travis Etienne, 12 carries, 27 yards, just, you know, couldn't get anything going there. I don't even know. Let's move on to the Lions. 24 for 29, Jared Goff continues to play pretty, you know, mistake-free football aside from that week last week. 24 for 29, as I said, 4-12, four touchdowns, no picks. David Montgomery and Jahmyr Gibbs continue to tear the league apart. 15 carries for 75 yards for Montgomery and two touchdowns. Jahmyr Gibbs, 11 carries, 69 yards, and a touchdown. Also had one very long catch for 54 yards. Really impressive run after the catch. Amra St. Brown, 11 for 161 and two touchdowns. Jameson Williams, 4 for 124 and a very long touchdown. This team is rolling right now. Best team in the league, I'd say. Definitely the best team in NFC. The Jaguars are a dumpster fire. Let's move on. The Browns and the Saints. Not much to look at with the Browns either. Deshaun Watson tore his Achilles. So now Jameis Winston is the starter. Everybody got what they wanted, and the Browns are still getting curb stomped. Jameis Winston, 30 for 46, 395, two touchdowns and no picks. The quarterback is not the issue here. The issue is their team's not very good as a complete team. Jerry Jeudy, 6 for 142, one touchdown. David Njoku, 9 for 81. Nick Chubb, 11 for 50, so he didn't have a very good game. Obviously, the Saints had a game plan to keep him in check. On the other side, you had Derek Carr, 21 for 27, 248, two touchdowns, no picks. Of course, nobody talks when he plays well, right? It's only when he plays like trash. Glad to see him back healthy. People need to be more consistent about their criticism of quarterbacks, so keep the criticism as loud, or I should say keep the credit as loud as you keep the criticism. There's a very real issue with people, whether it's sports pundits, idiots on Twitter and social media in general. You know, they're very loud about criticism, and when they're either proven wrong or that guy has a good week, they choose to shut up. Apparently their Wi-Fi's down that week. Not a fan of that. Vikings and the Titans. The Titans are, I mean, God, there's just a lot of bad teams in this league. Titans are 2-8. The Minnesota Vikings improved to 8-2, 23-13. They took this one. They'll take their third straight win with this one. 20 for 32, Sam Darnold was 246. Two touchdowns, no picks. Aaron Jones, 15 for 39. Not a very good week for running backs. Justin Jefferson, 6 for 81. Jordan Addison, 3 for 61 and a touchdown. Yeah, the Titans are bad. Next. Raiders and the Dolphins. The Dolphins took this one 34-19. Really liking how they're looking offensively right now. They improved to 4-6. The Raiders dropped to 2-8. They're definitely going to be taking a quarterback early in next year's draft. It's going to be interesting to see how that draft class pans out. You know, I'm looking at the Dolphins stat line here. You know, Tua Tagovailoa, 28 for 36, 288, three touchdowns, no picks. Devin Achane, 17 for 73, and a touchdown. Jonnu Smith sighting, six catches, 101 yards, two touchdowns. That's great to see as well. When you're getting production like that from, you know, a tight end that you really didn't expect to be this world beater, in this game, I think they should really start to, or I should say following this game, they should really start to try to look for him a bit more, because he was a very skilled pass catcher. Not only on the Patriots, but I believe he played for the Titans before that. Very, very capable pass catcher. You know, Tyreek Hill, pretty steady, 7 for 61 and a touchdown. So, you know, the Dolphins, like I said, they're right in the thick of things as far as the playoffs are concerned. Packers and the Bears, this is coming off the heels of the Bears firing their offensive coordinator. They dropped this game 20-19. The Packers improved to 7-3. The Bears dropped to 4-6. They're still in it. I think they had higher expectations this year for this offense. I mean, Caleb Williams, 23 for 31, 231, no touchdowns, no picks. They're having a hard time getting the ball in the end zone. It's interesting because Caleb Williams looks pretty advanced in his reads in the pocket. I think his main thing is he's trying not to roll out of the pocket so much and make some of those improvising or improvisational plays that he made at USC. I think he wants to prove he can really be effective from the pocket, but they need him to get out of the pocket more and make more plays on the run, in my opinion. Meanwhile, the Packers continue to roll. Jordan Love, 13 for 17, 261, one touchdown and one pick. Josh Jacobs, 18 for 76 and a touchdown. Christian Watson, big game, four catches for 150 yards. The Packers are rolling. Good to see Jordan Love healthy, as I said last week. That's great to see. Really good young quarterback. And we're going to see the Packers in the playoffs and see if they can make some noise in the playoffs. I don't think they're going to suffer any type of slide heading towards the end of the season. It seems like they're just going to keep this going. Moving on, Broncos and the Falcons. The Broncos took this one 38-6. This is just another example of really Kirk Cousins teams just not knowing what to expect from a Kirk Cousins team. They are 6-5. That pretty much, indicates exactly what I'm talking about as far as just consistently inconsistent. To only put up 6 points with some of the targets that you have and this, high price quarterback that you signed is pretty worrisome. I mean, 18 for 27, 173, no touchdowns on a pick. Bijan Robinson, 12 carries for 35 yards. That's just not going to get it done. This offense is struggling. Denver is pretty good defensively, definitely improving offensively as well, as they move to 6-5 and are right in the thick of things as far as the playoff race is concerned. Bo Nix, 28 for 33, 307, four touchdowns and no picks. I did say I wanted to see Sean Payton open up the offense a bit more for Bo Nix, and he definitely has done that as his trust in Bo Nix has grown as the season's gone on. The Broncos are a team that you are not going to want to see in the playoffs. And right now they are, right in the middle of this entire playoff picture. Next, we're going to talk about the Seahawks and the 49ers because I am really worried about the 49ers right now. They dropped this game at home 20-17. That is their second divisional loss at home. They also lost a game to the Cardinals at home, in which they gave up a pretty late lead at home. So they dropped to 5-5. The Seahawks improved to 5-5. This division really is a dogfight right now. Geno Smith sealed it with a late touchdown run. Didn't really play great. Protected the ball for the most part. Was sacked 4 times, but 25 for 32, 221, no touchdowns and a pick. Jackson Smith and Jigba, he's really coming to his own. 10 catches, 110 yards. DK 7 for 70. On the other side, I just really, it seems like there is, from the outside looking in, a serious locker room issue right now going on with the 49ers. And, you want to talk about Debo Samuel, who had 4 catches for 22 yards. This was a guy that I'm sure they expected to step up with Brandon Ayuk out for the season. Debo Samuel, who whined about being used as this utility back slash receiver type guy, these are his stats on the season: 33 catches for 490 yards, good for one touchdown. So if you're doing the math at home, that means he's mushed as many kickers in the face or holders or chewed both of them out. He's actually chewed more teammates out than he scored touchdowns this season. Not good. Not good. The body language on the sidelines is not good. They're 5-5 in a division that I'm sure they felt like they were going to run away with and, you know, work their way back to the Super Bowl. It's worrisome. You know, Juwan Jennings, he's a budding star in this league. 10 catches for 91 yards. He's been having a great year. Debo, one of your so-called, and I'm doing the quote marks, you can't see me, locker room leaders, is right now looking more like a cancer than he is a cure for their problems. So, I don't know, man. Like, Kyle Shanahan, people are saying he's on the hot seat. I wouldn't go that far. Let's see how this season pans out. They could still turn it around. But like I said, people like Debo Samuel on that team, you're not helping. I'll just leave it there. I mean, Brock Purdy, well, I'll say this, 21 for 28, 159, one touchdown and one pick. You know, with all of your targets pretty much there for the better part of, I'll say, the last couple weeks, you know, Brock Purdy hasn't played as well as one would expect. I think that is a cause for concern just a little bit. They did beat the Buccaneers, but when the targets were out, he actually played pretty well. So it's been an up and down season for Brock Purdy as well. It's going to be interesting to see how they close out the season. Now, my game of the week this week was the Bills and the Chiefs. The Bills took this one at home 32-21 to move to 9-2. The Chiefs are 9-1, so now the Bills will have the tiebreaker in a situation for the first seed if it comes down to that. Josh Allen sealed the game with a run on fourth down, I believe it was, and sealed the deal for this one. Pat Mahomes continues to have turnover troubles. 23 for 33, 196, three touchdowns and two picks. It's interesting because, you know, the Chiefs have been winning these games where their offense hasn't been looking very explosive. And yes, you know, Pat Mahomes has matured in this sort of West Coast esque offense where he doesn't need the explosive plays and has figured out how to take things underneath that are there. But at the same time, you know, I'm looking at Travis Kelce, and two catches for 8 yards is putrid in a big game where we need you if you're the Kansas City Chiefs. Like, we need Travis Kelce to be the Travis Kelce of the past, and quite frankly, he's not the Travis Kelce of the past, and I think that is mentally, I think that is physically. He has 62 catches for 507 yards and two touchdowns this year. It's just not, it's not clicking. I mean, you know, I'm looking at his stats, one game with 100 yards, another game with 90, another game with 89, half the games this year, he has four or less catches. It's just, you know, maybe he should have gone home. Maybe he should have taken his ball and gone home. Everybody who has criticized him for his on-field play and has alluded to his off-the-field relationship that has been so publicized with Taylor Swift, I'm sorry, but right now, they're right. They are valid in their criticisms, unfortunately. And I take my hat off to Jason Kelce for defending his brother, because that's what he's supposed to do. But as far as the football analysis of Travis Kelce right now, it is not looking good. It's not looking good. And they're going to need him down the stretch, because this is a situation with the Kansas City Chiefs that could spiral out of control very quickly if he does not show up in big games when they need him. They have not been blowing teams out. They have not been blowing the doors off offensively. And for him to have two catches for 8 yards in a big game like this against what I would consider a rival to the Kansas City Chiefs at this point is not good. It is not a good sign. I don't know if he needs to do some soul searching. I don't know if there needs to be some sort of intervention that happens between Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes in him, something needs to happen, because right now he looks like a shell of himself. Moving on to another sad situation, let's talk about this Bengals and Chargers game. Another one-score game that the Bengals drop. They dropped to 4-7. The Chargers improved to 7-3. Dropped this one 34-27. You know, they had a 21-point lead. They squandered it, and then they ended up closing this one out. But the story of really 2024, the entire season with the Bengals, is how well Joe Burrow has played, how well he is executed in late-game situations, and how poorly the rest of his team has executed, including the coaching staff, in these situations. I can't imagine how heartbreaking it has to be to continue to lose these one-score games. The Bengals are 1-6 in one-score games this season. In these one-score games, Joe Burrow has thrown 21 touchdowns, just one interception, in one-score games. It's just, it's perplexing. I mean, 67% completion percentage, 3,028 yards this season, 27 touchdowns, just four interceptions. You know, they haven't missed the playoffs in back-to-back seasons since he was drafted. And it's looking a lot like that's going to happen again this year. I don't know. On the bright side for the Chargers, they are looking great right now. Jim Harbaugh has come in and he has really changed the culture of this team. They look a lot more jubilant. They look a lot more energetic. The defense has found its way somewhat, and Justin Herbert does not have to throw the ball 50 times anymore for them to be in games. 17 for 36, 297, two touchdowns and no picks. If he can stay right in that 36 attempt range, they will win a lot of football games. Ladd McConkey, 6 for 123. You know, they don't exactly have a who's who at the wide receiver position, but you know, Justin Herbert has played great. J.K. Dobbins has played great coming off of his injury. He had two touchdowns. Gus Edwards as the backup running back, you know, he's always been. I mean, shoot, both of them running backs are from the Ravens. And they're really producing. You know, the line is protecting Justin Herbert really well, and the Chargers look really good right now. Another team you don't want to see in the playoffs. All right. Let's move on to the Monday game because, boy, oh boy. The Cowboys are just... I don't even want to spend that much time on this game. I mean, you know, the Cowboys have become similar to the Jets. They're everybody's bounce-back game. You know, the Texans took this one 34-10. They improved to 7-4. The Cowboys dropped to 3-7. And it's just, it's embarrassing. You know, this is one of the few times in my life that, excuse me, the Cowboys are really bad. And this all goes back to Jerry Jones. You have a diminished Ezekiel Elliott in the backfield, with Derrick Henry and all these other running backs that were out there in free agency. So you couldn't supplement the passing game with any type of run game, right? Dak gets injured. You would think they would see, well, let's see what Trey Lance has. Nope, Cooper Rush is playing because Jerry Jones is still delusional in thinking that this team has enough talent to turn this around. Rico Dowdle, 10 carries, 28 yards. Deuce Vaughn, 4 carries, 13 yards. Zeke Elliott, 1 carry, 8 yards. This is what all-in looks like, folks. You know, this is what all-in to Jerry Jones looks like. This is going all-in. And right now, it's a clear indication to me of what I've been saying for a long time. Similar to Woody Johnson, and actually in a more nauseating and extreme case, until Jerry Jones steps down or takes a step back from all things football operations, the Cowboys will continue to underperform. As for the Texans, it's not like I was impressed. You know, C.J. Stroud, 23 for 34, 257, no touchdowns, and a pick. He's taking a step back. Thank God for Joe Mixon, right? 20 carries, 109 yards, 3 touchdowns. Got Nico Collins back, 4 catches, 54 yards. Tank Dell, 4 catches, 54 yards. There was a point in this season where I thought the Texans could really compete in the AFC. That is gone. excuse me. I don't see the Texans competing in the playoffs the way that C.J. Stroud is playing right now. Stephon Diggs was a big loss. They are able to run the ball, but I think they can be had in a home playoff game by any of these teams that will potentially get that wild card, whether it's the Chargers or the Ravens, Dolphins. I just don't have much faith in the Texans right now. They are going to win this division, obviously, barring a monumental collapse. But I'm just not very impressed with the Texans right now. The Cowboys, which you already knew, dumpster fire. That is my Week 11 review. We are going to get into something that should not surprise me, but it's really starting to paint the picture of why folks are starting to tune out NBA basketball and NBA coverage. What I'm going to do right now is play this clip from Charles Barkley and his analysis of why Kenny Atkinson was fired from the Brooklyn Nets during the time where Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant were there. Let's listen to this.
People forget. Now, think about 3 or 4 years ago. We were bragging about Kenny Atkinson doing a great job in Brooklyn. He was doing a fabulous job. We're like, this guy might be the next really, really good coach. Then KD and Kyrie came there, and they kicked him off the ship. But because if you go back and look, he was doing a great job in Brooklyn. But then when KD and Kyrie came there, they kicked him off the ship.
All right. So after that blabbering, Whoopi Barkley style analysis of Kenny Atkinson's exit from the Brooklyn Nets, I decided I was going to do some research just to make sure that I wasn't tripping. And thankfully, some of us, we have access to the internet, right? So let's just take a look at something really quick, shall we? I have an article from the New York Times, I believe it is. Let me just bring it up. An article from the New York Times. This was in 2020, when Kenny Atkinson was fired by the Brooklyn Nets. So let's talk about this. All right, so I am going to read a few excerpts from this article, and you, in the comment section, can give me your opinion of what actually happened here. Because we're not going to do I always say it's like, inside the NBA is like The View, right? It's like a male version of The View. They get on there, They're bitter old men instead of bitter old women. They get on there and just gossip and talk about stuff they have no idea about. They have no facts. They have no type of, you know, supporting evidence. They just get on and just wing it. All right. So, let's talk about this. At halftime of the Nets 129-120 overtime win in Boston on March 3rd, Atkinson lit into his players and challenged them, sources say. It stopped short of escalating into a long back and forth, but this much was evident. Atkinson was not backing down. He was not holding back. He later pulled every starter off the court for the fourth quarter and let Caris LeVert and a group of reserves rally from a 21-point deficit. Then on Wednesday night, after a 39-point home loss to Memphis, no one held back. Atkinson walked into the post-game locker room and sat down in a chair and told his players and staff, "It is time to air our grievances out." The Nets held a spirited team meeting, according to sources, starting with several veterans expressing that they wanted to see Spencer Dinwiddie play like the player they know, and later with people in the room calling out Dinwiddie and DeAndre Jordan. Then perhaps the most crucial thing of all happened. Sources say Durant chimed in, pointing out that the Nets must improve their habits and that they are not building the proper culture traits necessary for a title contender. Now let's stop there. Charles Barkley alluded, and Shaq later in the clip, if you want to find it, it's on Twitter, it's everywhere, talked about this ball movement, this free-flowing ball movement, when the ball's moving, blah, 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 especially coming from Shaq, that's hilarious. Coming from a guy that said, if the big dog don't get fed, then the house don't get protected. Oh, shut up. Anyway, Charles Barkley alluded to the fact, basically, that they wanted Atkinson out because they didn't want to play ball the way he wanted to play ball. We'll get into that in a little bit, but let's talk about what Kevin Durant said here. The guy won two championships on Golden State. I think he would know a little bit about championship habits. Dedicating time to your craft. Taking your craft seriously. Building habits in practice, off the court, on the court, in games. That builds a championship team. He didn't say anything out of the way here. Okay? Now, the article after this, which I will put in the description box, it gets into how Kevin Durant tore his Achilles prior to that season. Mind you, so he wasn't even playing that year, which we all knew. Kyrie Irving only played 11 games that year. Okay? DeAndre Jordan was supposed to be part of this big three with them, to the point where they took a pay cut, Kyrie and Kevin Durant did, so that DeAndre Jordan could actually come and play with them because they felt like he was an important piece on a potential championship team. You want to know what happened? Kenny Atkinson decided he was going to start Jared Allen over DeAndre Jordan as some type of, oh, nobody's above the team. I'm going to break up this little good old boys club that doesn't exist, by the way, and I'm going to start Jared Allen until February of the season. Let's keep going. This is the only part that would give any credence to the, you know, Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving got Kenny Atkinson fired club. And even then, there's not really much here. Durant and Irving never connected with Atkinson, and there was growing belief that they did not have interest in playing for him when this team is whole next season, sources tell The Athletic. Now, here's the part that spits in the face of everything that y'all are talking about. It was not limited to just Durant and Irving, though. Several other players are also said to have begun disconnecting with Atkinson. And we're going to continue to spit in the face of this claim as we go through this paragraph. To be clear, a directive from Irving or Durant was not given to fire Atkinson. Marks and his front office are leaders of the franchise. The proper research must be done in gathering a pulse of the franchise is always ongoing. The belief had been that the stakeholders involved in the franchise would evaluate everything at season's end. However, enough information had been gathered prior to that, and even Atkinson, sources said, started to understand he had lost his most critical players. As a result, the Nets front office had to take all the information it had at its disposal to make a difficult decision. Now, this paragraph is really important here because this is going to be my main point of why I don't think Cleveland will succeed and why I don't think this Brooklyn Nets team under Atkinson would have succeeded if they did not cut bait. And yes, I know for the peanut gallery, oh, well, they didn't succeed anyway because they never won a ring. And yeah, because injuries had nothing to do with that. Okay, anyway, let's get to this paragraph. During Wednesday's spirited post-game meeting, the players did not shy away from criticizing Atkinson, expressing to the coach that they wanted him to identify roles better, communicate the team's hierarchy better, change what needs fixing, and not settle for the status quo. It summed up the growing displeasure with Atkinson's communication levels as well. Okay. Now, for those of you who watched Winning Time, all of this information was new to you. But for those of you who didn't watch Winning Time, this information will be new to you right now. There was a coach called Paul Westhead. Named Paul Westhead. Who had this elaborate scheme of a system of free-flowing offense and moving the ball, and no one part is better than the next part. And they won a championship, sort of in a fluky manner, with Magic Johnson as the best player on the team as a rookie because, you know, Kareem in that series got hurt, even though he was obviously probably still the best player in the league throughout the regular season. In that series against the Sixers, he was not, because he got hurt. And then Magic had his signature 40-point game in Game 6. We know. Okay. Magic got to the point where he was so annoyed with Paul Westhead because Paul Westhead refused to acknowledge that not everybody is the same, not everybody is equal on the team as far as the hierarchy is concerned, and trying to take the ball out of Magic's hands and make him play the two, that he told Jerry Buss, it's either me or Paul Westhead. And said it in the media, too. Here's the issue with Kenny Atkinson. And I'm going to read this sentence again. The players did not shy away from criticizing Atkinson, expressing to the coach that they wanted him to identify roles better, communicate the team's hierarchy better, change what needs fixing and not settle for the status quo. So what does this all mean? Similar to Paul Westhead. Establish who the best player on this team is. Who is the hub? Who is the hub of this team? Instead of you trying to pretend that every player on the team is the best player, which ends up being that there is no best player, right? Because you want all the credit because it's your system, right? Take the ball out of Magic hands. Who cares? You know, Norm Mixon can run point. Jamal Wilkes can bring the ball, right? Foolishness. It's the same thing here. On a championship team, everybody has a role. There's the best player. There's the Michael Jordan, LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, so on and so forth. Shaq. That's the hub. That's the player in which the offense runs through. There's never been a team that won a championship and did not have one of these. A go-to guy. A hub. A best player. And it was established in the locker room. Everybody knew and accepted if they wanted to be a part of this team, this was the hierarchy. Best player, second best player, spot-up shooter, defender, vocal leader, rebounder, post defender, energy guy off the bench. All of these things are roles. There were no roles on that Nets team. So the guys that were there playing this so-called free-flowing, free basketball. Everybody is equal. Everybody else playing that way. You want to know why it was working on the Nets prior to that, where they were, you know, exceeding expectations? It's because there was no chief amongst them that would, not only to say speak out, no clear chief that stuck out. Sure, D'Angelo Russell had the most talent on the team, but you had Spencer Dinwiddie, you had Caris LeVert, you had D'Angelo Russell. It's no different than when everybody hyped up the Clippers the year that Doc Rivers did this so-called amazing coaching job with the Clippers and took them to the playoffs. And it's like, oh, well, look at how many bench points they're scoring. Yeah, because they have no true starters or bench players. They're just putting guys out there. Everybody's kind of on the same level. So my point is, on a championship team, there's a hierarchy. He refused to have one. His hierarchy was coach and players. That's where it stopped. So, when Charles Barkley gets on TV and spews this BS about Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, who he's, by the way, been targeting for years. He's been targeting Kevin Durant since he went to Golden State. Cupcake this. You're riding on the bus, not driving the bus that. Sensitive this. Yeah, let's talk about Charles Barkley's career. Shall we? Should we talk about how you wanted a trade to the Portland Trail Blazers, who at the time were the best team in the West in 93? Who had just went to the finals twice? 1990 and 92? Should we talk about how Scottie Pippen was so critical of you during your time on Houston? Because you were fat and out of shape. Not committed to winning a championship. It didn't come from a guy who didn't win. It came from a guy who won six. Who was playing along a guy that won two. Alongside a guy that won two. As the best player on the team, Hakeem Olajuwon. Who also was playing alongside a guy that went to the finals twice as the best player. Won the finals as a key player on the Rockets prior to you coming there. You want to talk about sensitive? You kicked cameramen, spit on women during games. Who are you to criticize? This is what I talk about by The View. This is the male version of The View. Inside the NBA. And ESPN threw them a lifeline because casual basketball fans that don't care anything about the actual analysis of basketball, that's their fan base. And ESPN is just looking for any sort of hook to keep their viewership. Because right now, outside of ESPN sports contracts, to broadcast live sports games, they have nothing. First Take is a shell of itself, even if it's drawing ratings. Because once again, that's a casual type show. Even if it's drawing ratings, product-wise, it's a shell of itself. The only other thing you have to look to is an Inside the NBA broadcast. Where you find no type of basketball analysis worth listening to. So what do they do on this pregame show, halftime show, postgame show? They make up BS, gossip, rumors of four-year-old stories about players getting coaches fired. It's ridiculous. Maybe what Charles Barkley should do is shut up sometimes. He and Shaq could both learn to do that. Because Shaq is no angel here. He's the same guy that got schooled about pick and roll defense by Candace Parker as it is played in 2024. Or whenever the clip was, 2023, 2022. As it is played in this generation, he got schooled by Candace Parker about pick and roll defense. But hey, man, keep peddling the rumors and the gossip, Whoopi Barkley. It seems to be working out for you. Let's move on. I want to talk about this UFC 309 show. Pretty fun card. Saw a pretty impressive up-and-comer, Mauricio Ruffi, put on a striking clinic at times in this match. Showed a lot of instincts for punch selection, strike selection in general, punch placement, how accurate he is. You know, cage awareness. He needs to work on his stamina just a little bit, his gas tank. Granted, he was facing a guy that missed weight, but he moves to 11-1, and he's going to be somebody to watch in the UFC for sure, somebody to keep an eye on. So I was definitely impressed by that. That was a good opener to the main card. You had Bo Nickel improve to 7-0 against Paul Craig. Very tough matchup wrestling-wise. That's why I don't think he attempted many takedowns, obviously, in this match. This was basically a very technical, very well-fought match in the stand-up. In my opinion, Paul Craig, a pretty difficult matchup for him. Like I said, one of the best guards in all of MMA, I would say. If it gets down to the ground, Bo Nickel, obviously, a very impressive wrestler, but he chose not to attempt to take this fight down to the ground, just basically landed the more impactful shots on the feet. Of course, the idiot fans were whining, crying, booing every which way about this fight, because I don't know if they thought Bo Nickel was just supposed to take Paul Craig down and manhandle him. It just goes to show that a lot of UFC fans are casuals. There's just a lot of casual fans out there in all sorts of sports. I mean, you know, I think the most hardcore sports fans come from the sports that aren't as popular, aren't as attractive to the casual fan that's just flipping through the channels. And UFC has a big-time casual fan base that is more so bloodthirsty than they are appreciative of the type of, you know, skill that is going on in the ring in fights like this. So, of course, they whined and cried and booed during his, you know, post-fight interview and whatever. He, to me, put on a pretty good performance. I don't think he's quite on the level of a Khamzat, but I mean, he had a good showing. We'll continue to see him improve. He's only 7-0. He has plenty of time to go in his career. Charles Oliveira and Michael Chandler, let's talk about this one. This was by far the best fight of the night. Fire Fight Central. Thought somebody was going to sleep. But, you know, Oliveira got his back three times. Chandler got up three times from that, which was very impressive. He gained a new fan in me as a result of his performance here. He couldn't quite get it done. Oliveira was too much for him with those takedowns and, you know, submission attempts and controlling the fight on the feet at certain times. But Chandler definitely went into the fifth round looking like there was a chance that he could still finish it on the feet. And very entertaining fight. Like I said, Charles Oliveira had a key takedown in the fifth round to seal it. But, you know, Michael Chandler now, I don't know if he waits on a Conor McGregor fight next year or what happens. He's been waiting for that fight for a while. Would be a very entertaining fight, obviously. Don't see that one going the distance. But it would be exciting to see Conor not only get back in the octagon, but get back in the octagon against somebody like Michael Chandler. So that's going to be interesting. Let's move on to this main event, because I really did not enjoy this main event. John Jones versus Stipe Miocic, the some would say highly anticipated heavyweight championship fight. You know, Jones basically dog walked him to a knockout or a stoppage, I would say, with a spinning wheel kick. Stipe looked like a shell of himself. I'm not going to sugarcoat any of my criticism here for this, because quite frankly, I'm tired of the way that Dana White is continuing to allow certain things go on, or really perpetuate the things that go on in UFC as far as how some of these fighters are, you know, either thrown to slaughter for pennies, or, you know, other fighters are privileged to have fights like this that they put off as a super fight, and it's really not a super fight. Stipe retired after the fight. Quite frankly, he looked retired when he got in the ring. From the opening bell, he looked retired. He just looked tired. He looked real tired. Not even retired. Real tired. That's how he looked. Slow, lethargic. He wasn't coming forward, which I said on this podcast, he would need to come forward and force harder resets than just Bones circling out to the right, circling out to the left, walking back to the middle of the cage, resetting, and throwing strikes from range. Stipe didn't do it all night. His corner implored him, push forward. Chase him out when he's escaping, when he's circling, when he's moving out to the left or the right. Stipe didn't do it. He couldn't do it. He didn't have the foot speed to do it. You know, it's sad because this was a great performance from Bones, but to be honest, he was fighting a sitting duck. He came out and caught Stipe with a left cross that probably shocked Stipe, because Bones is nobody's puncher. Definitely ain't a counterpuncher. Didn't throw a counterpunch in this match. But he has improved his striking a little bit. A little bit. As far as punching is concerned. He's always had the elbows. He's always had the kicks. He dog walked Stipe on the ground in the first round and arguably got pretty close to a stoppage there. But, I mean, honestly, it wasn't even close. Like, there was no portion of this fight. There wasn't a second of this fight you could have given Stipe. Embarrassing is a word. So, let's move on to the more important part to me, which was the post-fight interview, where Bones says, oh, I thought about retiring. I'm not going to retire. I'm going to stick around a little bit. And maybe if Hunter and Dana pay me what I want, then you guys might get what you want. Come on, man. Do we honestly believe that Jones is going to fight Aspinall? Do we believe that even if he does fight Aspinall, it's going to happen anytime soon? You know, there are reports that Dana has promised Aspinall that it's not going to be a Michael Chandler, Conor McGregor situation. But we're dealing with a guy that has already made it clear he is not comfortable risking his legacy for what he deems to be chump change. What is he looking for as far as monetary compensation to fight Tom Aspinall, who is the rightful number one contender and the interim champ? What is he looking for? $20 million? Guaranteed? More so, does that sound like somebody confident that they would win that would say that? Is it worth me risking my record, legacy, reputation to lose to, quote-unquote, this guy? Right? I mean, like I talked about on the last podcast, he's changed his excuse a bunch of times about why he doesn't want to fight Aspinall. So, you know, in a matchup against Jones, Aspinall matches up better than anybody ever has. And we've seen guys, Alexander Gustafsson, Dominic Reyes, give Bones way more than he could handle on the feet. Reyes even more so. Reyes wasn't allowing those easy resets. he was winning the fight in the middle of the ring too. And coming forward. Had a decent ground game, but we never really, you know, got to that part in the thick of things. I think towards the end, Bones tried to get him down, did get him down. Quote unquote, finished the fight, as people would say. I still believe he lost that fight, but neither here nor there. Tom Aspinall has all those tools. Plus, he's the same height, damn near, if not taller. Weighs more, but is quicker. All-world wrestler. All-world striker. He's finished like five guys, pause, in the same amount of time that it took Bones to beat Stipe. So if there's anything that you'd be worried about as a betting man on Aspinall, it's experience, right? It's the bright lights. But as far as a matchup, Aspinall fits just fine in the octagon against Bones. If not, should be the favorite. So where does this leave us? Bones is going to play hardball about this match. And for a guy who just started, as far as a lot of people's perception, ducking people in Ngannou, getting to the heavyweight division, it's clear that he sees a completely different danger in the fight-changing power in the hands of those two guys. But also the fact that he's not going to find refuge taking the fight down to the ground with Tom Aspinall. He does have the best corner in MMA. Pretty much always had the best corner in MMA. But is that enough to stop this train going downhill, this snowball rolling downhill that is Tom Aspinall? I don't think it is. I would go on record right now saying I believe Tom Aspinall beats Jones in a heavyweight fight for the UFC Heavyweight Championship. Prove me wrong, Bones. I want to quickly go over this Tyson-Jake Paul fight, and I'm not going to break down the fight because, quite frankly, this was not a fight. This was a joke, which we all should have known it was going to be a joke going in. Mike Tyson came out, and as I said on my podcast last week, he had about two rounds of effectiveness. If he couldn't get him out of there after two rounds, it was going to get really ugly. Two rounds, that's it. He had about one and a half. He had a couple of bursts in the first half of the first round. Little burst in the second round, first half of that round. And that was it. That's all she wrote. They danced around. Jake Paul continued to show his lack of technique, his lack of basics. People claim he carried Tyson. I don't really care whether that's true or not. I'm looking at the technique. Terrible. Terrible. Low-level amateur stuff from Jake Paul. Never gets his legs into his punches, because he doesn't know how to activate his legs in his punches. Sit down on punches. Footwork's trash. Fights with his chin up. Right? All these things I've said before. So, like I said, I'm not going to relitigate this entire thing. After the fight, he called out Canelo. Canelo's not going to entertain that fight because why would you? We have a guy that hasn't beat any ranked opponent in any division. The only boxer he faced under the age of 58. See what I did there? He's only faced two boxers. The only boxer he faced under the age of 58 was Tommy Fury, and he got whooped. He got schooled. He got embarrassed. So, Jake Paul also has been called out by Artur Beterbiev. You think he's going to take that fight? Hell no. I will say what I've said for the longest time. This is a clown show. It's a novelty act. He's never going to fight any real prospects. He's never going to fight any real legitimate boxers. The day he does, he will retire after that fight because it will be against somebody that draws a lot of money, and that will be the end. He will go back to making YouTube videos, whatever he was doing before he started, quote-unquote, boxing. He'll go to WWE. What he doesn't want to be in is a fight with an actual boxer under the age of 58 or 38 or 28. Daniel Dubois offered him a chance at the heavyweight championship. He has a better chance of taking that fight, I guess. He might be delusional enough. Ryan Garcia says he wants a fight against Jake Paul. I'm sorry, in a storyline without babyfaces, Ryan Garcia is the lesser of two evils. At least he is a career boxer. That's his career. He juiced like a scumbag, missed weight on purpose against Devin Haney. But in a fight against Jake Paul, which, by the way, can't happen because what weight are they going to fight at? Old Juice, Jake was 227 for this fight and didn't look as puffy as he looked in past fights where he didn't fight at 227. So he's on something. Ryan Garcia fights at what? 147 at the most? What are they going to fight this at? 170? Is that the catch weight here? No. Ryan Garcia would be dumb to take that fight, even though he would beat the living snot out of Jake Paul in any fight that they, at any weight that they fight at. But it's just dumb for him to take that fight. Might as well wait around for the Devin Haney rematch whenever, you know, you're off suspension, which is going to be sometime in April, I believe. But like I said, in a Jake Paul versus Ryan Garcia fight, lesser of two evils like you guys like to vote for in these elections in this country, lesser of two evils, I'll take Ryan Garcia. That's about all I have to say about that. I don't want to spend too much time on Jake Paul. I've already spent too much time on Jake Paul, and that was only like 5 minutes of relitigating this clown show that happened this past Friday. But it's a clown show. It's a novelty act. It's a circus sideshow. That's what it is. And I'm glad more people are now seeing that, but that's neither here nor there. Let's get into one more thing. I do want to talk about WWE heading into Survivor Series, because there are some things that they're missing the mark on, in my opinion. For those of you who haven't been watching, the Old Bloodline and the New Bloodline are feuding. The Old Bloodline being Roman Reigns, Jimmy Uso, Jey Uso. Now Sami Zayn's been added back. The New Bloodline, Solo, former subordinate of Roman Reigns, Tama Tonga, Tongaloa, and Jacob Fatu. They are facing off at War Games. They have to find a fifth person, which the New Bloodline already has in Bronson Reed. And eventually, the Old Bloodline will get Seth Rollins on the team. I don't like this. I think it's forced. I think it doesn't make much sense, considering if Seth's reason for joining the OG Bloodline for War Games is that he lost a match to Bronson Reed, who he already beat, by Solo standing on the announce table, it's pretty weak to me. I could understand if, which I think they should have done, anyway, I could understand if Seth lost to Bronson Reed the first time, which he should have. But he didn't. So because he's 1-1 against Bronson Reed now, caused by Solo standing up on the announce table. It's not enough to warrant him going and fighting alongside somebody he claims he hates. I think it's weak. I think it's lazy. I think they've missed the plot on this entire thing. And I think they're not making very compelling television right now. Cody Rhodes would have been a good replacement. Or a good addition to further everything that went on with that tag team match versus Solo and Jacob. You're not going to get The Rock on the other side for Survivor Series, which would be the issue with that. But Seth and Bronson just seems a little lazy of an addition to me. You also had Rhea come back this past Monday and join this brigade of the babyface team with, I believe it's Io Sky, Bianca, Jade. It's just another lazy thrown together team match, really, as a whole. You know, Rhea was gone for 2 weeks because, I'm sorry, Naomi's also on that team. You know, Rhea was gone for 2 weeks because they broke her face or whatever they claimed. Now she's back to take on Liv, Nia Jax, Raquel, Tiffany, and Candice LeRae. It's just so thrown together. I think they had an idea that they were going to do War Games every year for Survivor Series, but do you really have to do one for the women this year if this is the best you could come up with as far as a blood feud? That's what War Games is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a blood feud. Neither of these right now feel like a blood feud. And then we move on to the part that to me was the most, it was the most egregious. Gunther last week got into a little back and forth in the ring with Damian Priest, to which Ludwig Kaiser came out and said, "I'm not going to let you talk to the ring general like that, you street trash." And then Damian Priest knocked him out. And then Gunther responded by getting in his face a little bit, and that was that. So then fast forward to this week, and Gunther is in the back with Kaiser and basically tells him, "You don't speak for me. You don't come out and do that while I'm having a back and forth with somebody. You need to make a name for yourself." Then proceeds to do what I think was absolutely ridiculous for Gunther's character to do, which was show insecurity in the way of asking Kaiser if he sees the same ring general when he looks in his eyes. Reminded me of Cool Runnings. When Yul Brynner, "Look in the mirror, what do you see? I see pride. I see power." That's what this was. This was Yul Brynner. "When you look at me, do you still see the same ring general?" This is what we're having Gunther do? Gunther, the ring general, the most dominant IC champ maybe ever. It currently, what he was supposed to be, dominant world heavyweight champ, is asking his subordinate if he sees the same ring general when he looks in his eyes. But wait, folks, there's more. It gets worse. right after this conversation, he sees Damian Priest sitting over at a table in the back, and he walks up to him, tries to put him in the chokehold that has beaten so many guys. Damian Priest shakes him off and beats the crap out of him. To the point he couldn't get a word in edgewise when Adam Pearce came over and said, "What the hell is going on?" And Damian Priest, "Oh, I'm just delivering a message to your world heavyweight champ." What? This is what we're doing with Gunther? This is the time that you're showing insecurity with Gunther? This is how you're displaying insecurity with Gunther? Wow. This may be the first time I could say that Triple H has lost the plot a little bit, man. Nobody on these shows feels important. Seems like just a month ago, a lot of people felt important. Nobody feels important right now. Gunther showing insecurity. I don't know, man. The WWE product right now is in a sort of rut that they need to get out of, because it is hard for me to care about anything on the show. It is hard for me to get excited about Survivor Series when things like that are being done. Things like Gunther asking his lackey if his lackey sees the same ring general when he looks into his eyes. So, that is a rather dreary conclusion to an overall dreary show of the Royal Hour. Wasn't the most positive episode. Obviously, there were some things we talked about that I disagreed with, didn't like, didn't enjoy, etc., etc. Obviously, every week won't be like this. If this is your first time listening to the Royal Hour, trust me, it is not like this every week. I'll be back next week with some things on my mind, some things I want to get off my chest. We will continue to review the NFL season, week 12. We will talk about some things in the NBA and anything else that surfaces around that time. Until then, stay healthy, stay blessed, stay positive, productive, all those good things. And until then, I will see you guys down the road, aka next week. So until then, peace.